the sommelier comes, opens the wine for you, wearing a mask, holding gloves, and then Lysols the bottle before leaving it on the table for you. Like, that doesn't sound so compelling.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. I think probably one of the most relevant guests that I can think to bring to you guys these days is probably Vikram Mancharamani. He's a lecturer at Harvard University and the author of a great book from a while back, Boombastology, and the upcoming Think for Yourself, Restoring Common Sense in an Age of Experts and Artificial Intelligence, which comes out in June. He's a frequent commentator on issues driving disruption in the global business environment. Spoiler alert, it has been disrupted pretty mightily over the last few months, right? And LinkedIn has listed him as the number one top voice for money, finance, and economics in consecutive years. And in addition to teaching and writing, he also advises several Fortune 500 CEOs on how to navigate uncertainty in today's dynamic global business environment. And we talk today about predicting and forecasting how things will look post-COVID economically, future supply chain redundancies, addressing short-termism in terms of how we think, the impact towards academics and remote work, and so much more. So let's jump right in. So Vikram, welcome to Future Proof.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we are recording this, I think, in the middle of a global pandemic, which is always a fun thing to say. It's not something I really thought I'd ever be, you know, saying, but I think that at the very least, it's great to talk to people who have the background to really respond and give people some good information about how they should be thinking about the future. So, you know, first off, what I'd like to ask people is, you know, who the heck are you, you know, in your own words, and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. No, I appreciate the question, Jeremy. So I think of myself as a generalist, and I start with that description rather than a functional description, because I do think of myself as broad, as looking across silos, someone who cares about what's happening in politics, cares about what's happening economically, happens to have a day job teaching. I teach in an engineering school, but I'm not an engineer. I happen to also write about finance as well as decision making. And so I think of myself as a generalist first and foremost, but more traditional labels might be I am an author, I've written a couple books. I'm an academic. I've taught classes both at Yale and at Harvard, and I'm an advisor. I spend some time talking with corporate boardrooms predominantly, but every now and then management teams as well, to think about how to navigate uncertainty. That's really the topic of interest.
And I think obviously a lot of people are trying to anticipate the exact economic repercussions of COVID-19. And I think all the people who I know, like you, who are smart enough to have some, you know, way of thinking about it, know that they're not going to get it perfectly right. But that being said, can you please get it perfectly right for us?
I get found the whole academic research endeavor was so focused on being right. So focused on precision and trying to get that quote unquote rigor of, you know, the regression and this and that, that I decided I would rather be approximately right than precisely wrong. And so I think I can give you a neighborhood. I can give you a neighborhood that we're going to be in when it comes to economic activity. And unfortunately, it's not a positive prognosis here. I think, you know, there was a recent working paper that the National Bureau of Economic Research posted from some University of Chicago professors that did some analysis on job losses. Turns out the estimates right now, roughly 40, 45% of job losses may prove to be permanent. So that's not a good prognosis. Let's start with something like that. And then think about it from your own day-to-day life, right? I mean, when are you next going to go out to a restaurant and spend a lot of money, have a bottle of wine, and sit around for hours? I don't know. I'm not sure I want to go. Again, we're recording in the middle of the pandemic. Depending on when you air this, it may or may not be relevant. But, you know, would you show up at a place where the host has a plexiglass screen in front of them? You tell them that you're here for your reservation. You get seated at one table. The three tables around you have to be empty for social distancing reasons. The waiter or waitress shows up with a mask on and gloves, hands you disposable menus. You put your order in. The sommelier comes, opens the wine for you, wearing a mask, holding gloves, and then Lysols the bottle before leaving it on the table for you. Like, that doesn't sound so compelling.
Yeah.
When's the next time you're going to get on an airplane and go in this small little aluminum cabin across the country to go check into a hotel room, which you don't know who slept in that bed before or how sanitized it was that night, and then go sit in a crowded ballroom with lots of people that came from all over the world to listen to people that came from someplace else, and then go eat on a buffet with all these people on top of the food you're putting in your mouth.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound so regular. So anyway, that's the anecdotal stuff. But really quickly, if you wanted me to sort of break down into econo-speak, 70% of the global 70% of the American economy is the U.S. consumer, of which 70% is services. And services are restaurants, travel, the anecdotal stuff. So I don't think there's huge pent-up demand that people talk about. I think that, unfortunately, you know, if I take my family out to eat once a week on average for a nice meal, you know, we've skipped 10, 12 weeks already. Probably skip another 10, let's say, just for hypothetical reason. So when we eventually start going back, we're not going to have 25 meals built up in us. We'll just go back to once a week. This is a complete loss. And, you know, number of restaurants that are out there, number of travel-related enterprises, et cetera, these are long-lasting impacts. So, you know, that's I think, how I'm thinking about it now. The only other comment I would make is a lot of people ask about the economic trajectory in sort of this alphabet soup of descriptions, right? Is it going to be a V? Or is it going to be a U? Or is it going to be a W? Or is it an L? God forbid, we don't want it to be an L. And, you know, the more recent question I was asked by some folks in the media this morning was, Vikram, do you think it possibly could be a lowercase h? And I was like, wait, what? And then, like, it goes down and sort of slowly goes up and then it goes down again. I don't know. I can't tell you the trajectory, but I can tell you there's a lot of headwinds.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about what you said is that when you have this unprecedented time where it's a very difficult, you know, to look at it and say, oh, this is exactly what it resembles. And for this reason, this is exactly what it's going to go back to. I spoke to an epidemiologist who pointed out, you know, that you can make all the comparisons you want to, you know, 1918. And the problem with that is, you know, now we have a lot more immunity, you know, and a lot more super viruses that are going to be out there over the next X number of years, but also you've got travel and the ability to move around much quicker than ever before, and that's going to spread it. But I think at the very least, you know, in all of that negative, I don't want to say negativity, but in all of that pragmatic advice that you just gave, I think to me, at least the glimmer of hope is that so many things are disrupted in a major way that people will be forced to innovate and move towards different sectors and find, you know, other things to do of value to society. So I don't know if you've started to think about that or look into that in terms of what will those growth sectors or industries even be?
Sure. Well, I think that you're right to highlight, Jeremy, that there's massive disruption across the board. Virtually every industry, I think, is being disrupted. On a very big macroeconomic perspective, you know, one of the things I would highlight is this is exposing vulnerability in the global supply chain. And as these vulnerabilities in the global supply chain get noticed, we're going to see a reshoring of activity back towards the United States, I think. Right. I was just doing some more than 90% of the vitamin C in America comes from China. More than 90% of the antibiotics come from China, or 70%. But anyway, it's large numbers. I mean, these are things to think about. Right. I mean, these are not trivial developments and exposures. And so, you know, maybe it turns out the antibiotic pharmaceutical ingredient industry in America is about to boom. I mean, maybe, I don't know. So that's the very macro thing, is that these supply chains are going to shorten and get closer to consumers.
Because I was just going to say, I know that there's a thing that you talked about just-in-time efficiency versus just-in-case resiliency, which I'm wondering if you could kind of define for people. But I think also, in some ways, it sounds like what you're talking about is essentially, let's not, you know, let's be a little bit more conservative in terms of protecting, you know, the interests of any given country, rather than kind of assuming that this global supply chain, very globalization, you know, oriented view of society has no drawbacks.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the theme of this most recent book of mine, which is, you know, you got to learn to think for yourself and sort of put that front and center. And what that may mean is, look, I need to understand both the pros and cons of all decisions I'm making. And it's not okay to just focus on one half of that equation. And so the pros of globalization were lower prices and sort of, you know, efficient supply chains, just-in-time inventory. the cost was loss of resilience and vulnerability, right? Those were real costs. And now we're rebalancing those benefits and costs. And I think that's going to cause a change. But yes, you're right. I think we've gone from, and I've described it as just-in-time, lowest cost efficiency as the motivating architecture and logic of supply chain strategy, towards just-in-case, resilient, safety, security, and, you know, assurance of availability supply chain structures and strategies.
I think that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting. I mean, how do we, you know, as people who've been functioning in this very globally, you know, really interconnected web for, you know, the last X number of decades, really, how do we kind of separate out the pros of globalization versus these inherent negatives that we've now woken up to, or that, and so, you know, and I have no particular point of view here. I'm just wondering, there are inherently, you know, some advantages, surely, and there are clearly some drawbacks that we're being exposed to now. So I'm wondering if there's any way for us to, you know, parcel out the good things about, you know, rather than, you know, pivoting too far and then all becoming very protectionist and not having any benefits of having this, you know, global economy.
Sure. I think one of the things that's going to happen is we'll have redundancy as part of it. And it's not going to, I mean, the corporate boardrooms I've talked to that have supply chains running through Asia or even China are not proposing to remove them entirely yet. What they're suggesting is, okay, I had all of my supply coming from this one plant in China. And when that lockdown happened, that scared me. It was one thing before. I was nervous because of the economics, trade war, tariffs, saying, uh-oh, my parts may become more expensive. But then when my parts couldn't even get to me, that's a whole nother level of anxiety and risk it produced. And so I think one of the dynamics we're seeing right now is, okay, I've got some in China, I'll leave some in China, but let me rebuild at least 50% capacity here in the United States. And therefore, I could surge the United States to take care of a breakdown if it happened over there. So sort of an attempt to get the best of both worlds, as you're talking about.
It's funny, because as you're talking about that, it sounds very similar to me. And then I realized it's the whole entire aspect of having a diversified stock portfolio, you know, which is something that I think you don't really see that much controversy around when you give people that advice with respect to their personal finance. But then with respect to your manufacturing as a billion-dollar company, it's not something that people were doing. And it's just interesting to look at the juxtaposition of those. And I feel like the same principle kind of is in place in both of those circumstances, but yet it took this to make us realize that.
Yeah, I think it's also some short-termism. Look, Jeremy, I think one of the biggest ailments facing American financial and economic activity, sort of a real disease that should be addressed, is short-termism and the desire to put up the corporate profits this quarter, this quarter, this quarter, guidance, hit the numbers, hit the estimates, et cetera, for public companies. That's an overwhelming pressure that's put on them. And look, resilience comes with a cost, right? It's redundant to have two supply chains, right? Why not just have one, get the benefits of scale and get lower cost? The value shows up at times like this. You know, just like you probably feel good about having a diversified portfolio today, I would argue to you that over the last 5 years, you probably would have been a lot better off just owning Amazon, Google, pick your stock, right? Just that. You didn't need a diverse. In fact, concentrated, very specific portfolio works really well when you pick the right one going in the right direction. It doesn't work so well when you don't know what the future holds. And so I think this is creating that dynamic of, okay, let me pay a little insurance, and that there's a cost for resilience, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But that requires a longer term thinking. And I my argument is resilience in the longer run actually leaves you ahead because you didn't get that blip.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, it sounds like what you're talking about is almost redefining what it means to be a quote-unquote pure capitalist, right? Because if you're trying to maximize your short-term gains and you're thinking very short-term, well, then you're not really maximizing gains because you're leaving yourself exposed to these risks that, frankly, basically every single company has seen themselves exposed to. I can't think of a company out there that I know of that was able to hedge their bets and kind of predict a black swan event to this extent. And as a result, they're doing well when everybody else is suffering. It just seems like you said, the pressure of the markets is to think in this short-term kind of way, which then has long-term impacts and ultimately doesn't really put, you know, the investor's dollar first.
Yeah, no, look, I think the short-termism problem is a real problem. And I think you're describing it well.
How about, I'm wondering about some other impacts that maybe you're noticing or thinking about. I mean, one thing that I was thinking about is academia and life on campus and, you know, remote learning. And will more people say, you know what, we should not pretend that, you know, like you can actually get something from remote learning. And, you know, this is a grand global experiment that we're undertaking right now, whether we wanted to or not.
I'll give you personal examples and stories here. So Harvard University, I would suggest, would never, ever, ever have taken all classes online unless they were forced to, right? Or just they wouldn't have done it. The faculty's entrenched, they've got their own motivations. They would never do it. They did it out of sheer necessity in March of this year. And so I started teaching my class online. Because I do a fair amount of public speaking, was well-versed in some of these technologies. I knew how to use Zoom, et cetera. And the class I teach is a seminar focused on discussions. And we break up into small groups and we have group work, et cetera. But that was easy to move online. And I'm going to even go so far as to suggest that it quite possibly, just maybe, is even better online than in person. From a teaching perspective, not from a holistic perspective, but from a teaching perspective, because I have the ability to put different people in different breakout rooms in Zoom. I have the ability to have them do whiteboarding activities, and I can sort of covertly watch multiple groups at the same time as the instructor. So that helps. And then they don't have the cross-contamination of one person sitting in this side of the room and the other in this side of my classroom, where they end up seeing what each other's are doing, looking out of their corners. Oh, he's got a map that way, he's got a map that way. And they sort, so the cross-contamination is not there. And then when I poll people and ask them, you know, in class, how many of you, they put up their hands, everyone sees, and if 80 hands are up, 80% of the hands are up, the other 20 are like, well, okay, maybe. And you get groupthink. That doesn't happen online. People don't see the total pool until the voting's done. And so you actually get, I think, a different experience, which might be as good, if not better, from a learning and teaching perspective, not from the social and relationship building perspective, I think, but from those other perspectives, possibly equivalent. And I think to get to the bigger topic you raised here, which is impact on academia, it's conceivable to me that this is one way academia adapts, in that we end up finding large numbers of classes are taught online. Right? Not all. You can't do a chemistry class with labs online, but discussion, lecture type courses, maybe. And I think there ends up being a hybrid, and this reduces the cost of education for most people. And if you reduce the cost, maybe you can start chipping away at that student loan problem.
Oh, I mean, that'd be great, especially because as you think about it, there are all these things that I think about, you know, especially with, granted, my kids are in first grade and, you know, pre-K, but there are all these things that you get used to about the old type of learning that you bemoan that you've lost, when the reality is maybe those things weren't inherently better. Maybe they're just the things that we were used to. And that's kind of, in some ways, I'm not saying that the new paradigm is perfect, but kind of like what you're touching on, there are some advantages that until we were forced to run this experiment, we weren't aware of.
I think what's actually happening is we're starting to unbundle the value of education into its constituent parts, right? So there's a social component. People go to college because they want to build a friendship they want to build a network of friends. And young kids their age, similar motivations, similar capabilities, going to go off in life, and they've got a good core group, and it's a fun time. Great. I'm not taking away that value. But that's very distinct value from the value of in-person, in-class, synchronous education, right? Those are two different values you're bringing to that. We bundle them in a college, residential college experience, and you argue that the cross-pollination of talking about materials while you're sitting at the dinner table with your peers in the dining hall, and there's value there. And I give you, yes, there is. No question there's value there. But there's disproportionate value for learning in the classroom, and, you know, that individual and disproportionate value for socializing in the non-classroom time. And so, you know, we're unbundling those, but we're also learning what can be done synchronously versus asynchronously, right? I mean, we've heard about this flipped classroom. Let's let students watch the single best physics introductory lecture from whoever in the world can teach it best. You know, so there should be a reduction in the number of physics 101 instructors in the world, right? There just should be. You should find the best one and put them online. And then the nuances, the experiments, that angle of education can be done with instructors real time in a lab environment. But we don't need to waste the time of everyone in different ways and make it more efficient. So I think that's education is going to definitely shift. You know, I don't know what the new reality looks like, but these are some ideas I've got.
No, I think that's great. And I know we have to let you go soon, and we should definitely have you on again at some point, because I know you got that book coming out, which we should definitely be talking about. I do want to ask you a little bit about the social media, the rise of social media even further as a result of COVID-19, because I think obviously it's, you know, we're all looking at people who are sometimes, they have the ability to consume in a way that we don't right now, which I think is interesting, depending on where your friends are located. But I mean, is there anything that you've looked into? And, you know, is there anything that's a portent of things to come in terms of how we're using social media now and how we're probably going to keep using it after the pandemic's over?
Sure. Well, Jeremy, first of all, I'm happy to come back whenever you'd like. Thank you for the invitation to return. But in terms of social media, in fact, it's a nice segue. We can talk about it next time, perhaps. But in my book, I talk about overwhelming choice and overwhelming information quantity and sort of data overload and sort of drowning in information and that feeling that characterizes the world we're in today. And one of the things that that does is it leads to this constant comparison and this desire to optimize rather than be satisfied. And that comes across with a relative comparison logic in social media. And so when it comes to the domain of social media, one has to think about whether one is getting a biased sense of reality. And so the way I describe it is this. Think about the number of posts that you personally or any of your listeners may have that are highlighting real personal setbacks or failures. I mean, oh, I just lost my job. Let me tweet it. Just lost my job. Had a horrible day. Screwed up a project. Missed it. What? No, people don't do that. They're talking, the tweet is, just got promoted, big days, new responsibility, big job. Think of the LinkedIn feeds. Congratulations on the new job. Not, I'm sorry to hear you lost your old one, if they lost, right? I mean, sort of the social media world is biased in a major way, and it distorts one's sense of reality. It gets more extreme if that's your only portal into the world, which is really concerning to me during this time of COVID and the lockdowns, right? So I'm sitting here, I'm struggling. Oh my God, so-and-so lost their job. This, I know my friend. And then you go online and you see nothing but, wow, that person just got a promotion. That person just got a job. Oh my God, that person just got a new book published. That person just did this. That person, wow. Oh my God, I'm really falling behind. And, you know, it's FOMO as, you know, sort of that optimization logic that emerges when you have so much information and choice, you want the absolute best choice that, you know, to be optimal in all ways. That fear of missing out on optimization comes across socially as well. What am I missing out on? Oh my God. And social media exacerbates that. It makes it more intense. It puts a focus on appearances rather than actual experiences. And, you know, they get all sorts of people who manage what they look like online that are very different than reality. And so, you know, I think it's something we need to exhibit a lot of caution with going forward, and especially during this pandemic. Parents, for sure, I know I, as a parent of two kids, think about this a lot. Like, what is my kid's sense of reality? What are they thinking about? Because I want to make sure they understand that what they see online is one part of the world, and there's a whole nother part that people tend not to share online.
Yeah, well said. I think that you're right, this exacerbation of something that was really moving very starkly in one direction even before this. And the question is, how much has this accelerated it even? So I think it'll be really interesting to follow along with. You know, I know you have to go. This was fantastic. And thanks so much for sharing with us, and to be continued.
Great. Thanks very much, Sharon.
Thanks so much, Vikram, for a very informative conversation. And I got to say, I wish I had more time with him. I think we're going to make a little bit more time to jump into his upcoming book over the next few weeks. So stay tuned for that conversation. If you'd like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Futureproof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Futureproof.